Radio Prague International, the external service of Czech Radio. News.
Inflation in the Czech Republic reached 16% in May. Analysts expect further interest rate hikes. Unions are on strike alert in support of their demand for higher wages. And Czechs are commemorating the Lidice massacre by the Nazis 8 years ago. Inflation jumped to 16% in May, accelerating from 14.2% in April, according to data released by the Czech Statistics Office. The cost of housing, food and fuel continues to rise, and analysts predict a further increase this and next month. Inflation is now at its highest since December of 1993, when prices rose by 18.2% year on year. Analysts are predicting that the Czech National Bank will respond to the latest data with another significant hike in interest rates. Meanwhile, several unions in the public sector are on strike alert as of Thursday in support of their demands for higher wages. The Czech Confederation of Trade Unions is pushing for a pay rise in the public sector to cover inflation, but the government has ruled that out as unacceptable in view of the state of public finances. The Prime Minister further argues that a large wage hikes across the board would only trigger an even steeper inflation spiral. Due to the soaring inflation, real wages in the public sector have fallen by 8.4% in the last 4 months alone. The Czech Republic is commemorating the victims of the destruction of Lidice, which was razed to the ground by the Nazis on June 10th of 1942 in a brutal revenge for the assassination of Nazi Governor Reinhard Heydrich. 173 men were shot dead. The women and most of the children were transported to concentration camps. The 80th anniversary of the tragedy is being marked at home and abroad, since several towns and villages worldwide adopted the name Lidice in solidarity with its inhabitants. The European Commission has accused Czech Railways and the Austrian rail carrier ÖBB of having entered into a secret agreement on used passenger rail cars that damaged the Czech operator Regiojet. The Commission concluded that the Czech and Austrian companies had entered into collusion with the aim to prevent the expansion of Regiojet both in the Czech Republic and on the international railway line between Prague and Vienna. It sent both companies a statement of objections. The EU authorities have been investigating the case for over 6 years. Hackers are demanding tens of millions of crowns from the Road and Motorway Directorate to unlock vitally important data from its systems and storage facilities, Radek Martel, director of the directorate, told Hospodarské noviny. The ransomware attack took place on May 17th and experts have so far failed to recover the data. The process could take at least 5 months, which means that tenders for the construction of roads and motorways will be delayed. Martel said the directorate is considering paying out the money in view of the damage that the loss of data would incur. The annual Book World Festival, currently underway in Prague's Výstaviště Fairgrounds, is showcasing Ukrainian authors this year, presenting books by 19 Ukrainian publishers. Ukrainian ambassador Yevhen Perebinis, who was present at the opening of the festival, welcomed the spotlight on Ukrainian culture. The festival runs until Sunday, and Ukrainian refugees in this country have free entry to it. Now, a quick look at the weather forecast. Saturday should be clear to partly cloudy and mostly dry, with day temperatures between 22 and 26 degrees Celsius. I'm Daniela Lazarová, and that's the end of the news. You are listening to Radio Prague International, the external service of Czech Radio. Coming up in the program, the Czech Republic is marking 80 years since the Lidice massacre by the Nazis. We'll talk to the head of the Lidice Museum, historian Edvard Stehlík. From the world of art, Czech National Museum experts are to restore a number of valuable artifacts from Syria. Some of them 4,000 years old. We'll explain how that has come about. And later on, we'll hear an interview with a British adventurer, Benedict Allen. Stay with us. Exactly 8 decades ago, on June 10, 1942, the central Bohemian village of Lidice was annihilated by Nazi forces in retaliation for the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich. About 340 men, women and children were murdered and the village flattened. Lidice became one of the best-known examples of Nazi Germany's brutality, and its legacy survives in many forms to this day, as Tom McEncrow reports.
2 weeks after acting governor of Bohemia and Moravia Reinhard Heydrich was attacked by two undercover Czechoslovak soldiers in Prague, an SS commando drove into the village of Lidice and began to systematically annihilate the entire settlement. All of the males over the age of 15 were shot, while the vast majority of women and children would eventually be murdered in Nazi death camps. The village itself was levelled to the ground, and even the graveyard was destroyed. The story of how Lidice came to suffer such a devastating fate has been recounted many times. It is a combination of Nazi frustration, bad luck, and a meeting between Adolf Hitler and Karl Hermann Frank, who was in charge of the crackdown following Heydrich's killing. But there is also a second story of Lidice, one that shows how much the savage action, propagated by the Nazis as a warning, resonated around the world, says historian Eduard Stehlík, who is the director of the Lidice Memorial.
3 days
after the attack, the U.S. Secretary of the Navy, Frank Knox, said that when future generations ask why the Allies fought this war, then they will be told the story of Lidice. I think that was one of the first reactions. The destruction of the village resonated strongly both in North and South America. The same can be said for Britain, where the first reports actually falsely stated that Lidice was a miners' village. While there were some miners living there, it was mainly a settlement of metal workers. Nevertheless, this initial report mobilized British miners who formed the Lidice Shall Live movement that collected donations already during the war to rebuild the village.
A year later, the British made a film called The Silent Village, where the fate of Lidice is played out on a miners' village in Wales. Several cities would also name streets and squares after the Czech settlement, with some villages even temporarily renaming themselves to Lidice altogether. In South America, the word Lidice would turn into a name given by some parents to their daughters, says Dr. Stehlík.
That is one of the most powerful reactions that I have come across. In some cases, it has even become a tradition, and you have multiple generations of women who carry the name, even if they may not know where the name originally comes from. We're actually working with a journalist now who is traveling across South America and tracking the footprint left by Lidice there. We weren't aware of how large this legacy is. We plan to publish a book on this topic that he is writing within the next 2 years.
There are very few survivors of the Lidice massacre still alive today. Most of them are children who are either too young to recall the events or still in their mother's wombs at the time. But one of them told Dr. Stehlík that as long as people still talk about Lidice, the village and its people do remain alive.
Tom McEncrow with that report. Moving on now, the National Museum in Prague has brought some 20 valuable artefacts from Syria to the Czech Republic to be restored by local experts. The objects, dating back to the Bronze Age and antiquity, will then be displayed in the National Museum's historic building before returning to their homeland. Ruth Frankova has the story.
5 large wooden crates from Damascus were transported to the National Museum's restoration work shops in Terezín last week under strict security measures. Carefully packed inside were 20 valuable artefacts, some of them up to 4,000 years old. Michal Lukeš, the head of the museum, says it is not the first time the National Museum in Prague is assisting in the protection of Syria's cultural heritage.
This cooperation has been going on for almost 5 years. We established it as part of the government's program to provide humanitarian development and reconstruction assistance in Syria, which includes helping to save cultural heritage. Our main partner is the General Directorate of Syrian Monuments and Museums, which is in charge of all the museums and monuments in the country.
Having already sent materials to Syria to protect the country's museum collections, the Czech Republic will now provide expertise in restoring the objects damaged by the Islamic State. Among them is a statue of a woman with a large part of her face chipped off. The artwork comes from the city of Palmyra, as do three tombstone reliefs. Samir Massad from the Syrian embassy in Prague outlines the dramatic circumstances of their rescue.
The archaeologists in Syria managed to load many objects on trucks and bring them to Damascus. Unfortunately, some of the staff paid for it with their lives. The world-renowned scientist Khalid Assad was executed because he did not want to hand over the valuable artifacts from Palmyra to the Islamic State.
According to Mr. Massad, many historical artifacts were also stolen by the Islamic State and disappeared on the black market. Most of the objects brought to the Czech Republic, such as the bronze pin from Ugarit, are made of metal, since the National Museum's experts specialize in restoring this material. Petra Korandová, the head of the museum's restoration department, outlines the next steps in the process.
First, we have to examine the objects. We will take pictures both under a microscope and in our studio so as to capture all the details. That will help us to determine how to proceed with their conservation.
The restoration work, which will also include experts from Syria, is expected to take about a year. But before the valuable items are sent back to their homeland, Czechs will get a chance to see them, says Mr. Lukáš.
We have agreed that the artifacts will not be reserved just for the Syrian public. As soon as the restoration work is completed, we will prepare an exhibition in the historic building of the National Museum. The objects will be displayed there along with other items related to cultural heritage in Syria.
Michal Lukáš, head of the National Museum in Prague, ending that report by Ruth Franková. A reminder that you're with Radio Prague International, the external service of Czech Radio, where we're now inviting you to hear Ian Willoughby's interview with UK adventurer Benedict Allen.
Explorer, writer and broadcaster Benedict Allen is known for daring travels to such spots as the Amazon, Papua New Guinea and the Gobi Desert. The UK adventurer has documented his often solo journeys in a series of books, as well as TV programmes for the BBC and other broadcasters. However, in recent years, Allen has been in a rather different environment, Prague, a city he now calls home. When we spoke recently, he told me his earliest inspiration was his test pilot father.
He was always travelling away, testing his aircraft in the tropics, and he used to bring back, I remember, a weaver bird nest and then a stuffed crocodile, just a baby stuffed crocodile, an adder that he put in a bottle. All these exciting things made me think there's a world elsewhere. But I think it also made me feel it's possible to do these things. I knew I couldn't be a test pilot, I mean, especially with a nuclear deterrent. I mean, I'm much more passionate than my dad. My dad was very, very steady. But I felt I could do something else out there. And I clung on to this dream of being some sort of, if not pioneer, but some sort of explorer character, someone who's investigating the world. And at school, I was getting a bit desperate about my dream because I didn't seem to have what it took. I mean, I didn't have money was the main thing. But I thought, how am I going to be an explorer, especially when everyone's telling me the world's been explored? And I just thought I'd give it a go. I worked in a warehouse. I used to stack books in this warehouse, and I got enough money just to go off my first adventure. And I headed off to the Orinoco and Amazon just to, well, just seize this one chance I thought I'd get before having what my mum called a proper job. And I settled into this life of being some sort of explorer simply because I found it was possible. It was possible almost entirely due to the local people, indigenous people. I live with the people I used to call Indians, you know, the people of the Amazon, and they kept me alive. and I decided that's the way I would do my adventuring. I wouldn't have much money in my career, but I would go to local people and learn to see places like the Amazon or Borneo or New Guinea as a home and not a threat, because explorers always talk about the snakes and piranhas and how terrible these places are, but to the locals they're a home.
You edited the Faber Book of Exploration. Do you see yourself as part of this lineage of great explorers, or has that all changed now with technology? Because those people, some of them went away for years.
Yep, I do go away for a long, long time. I am part of a tradition, and of course the British, and I am British, for better or worse, there's a lot of these explorer types. I was certainly in the 19th century, and I'm often regarded as a bit of a relic from a previous era. I'd say what I do is very, very different. Instead of going as an outsider to study people and perhaps expand the empire, which was often what it was like for the British, the locals felt that very much. And so I'm just going to try and listen and learn and immerse myself. So it's a very different tradition from that point of view. It's all about disappearing into a place rather than sort of marching across it. But nonetheless, it has to be said that I am part of a long tradition. And I think it's very important, and I try and stress this whenever I talk to children, that exploration isn't actually something from the past. It seems like it. That's what we're always told. Exploration's over. I was told as a child that it's finished. But the truth is, we don't understand the world, and we need to understand it now more than ever. And so I'm one person who's fortunate enough to follow his dream, and I do what I always wanted to do. But I think actually it's about all of us doing the same. All you and your job, everyone in their job, is investigating the world. It's what humans do. In fact, it's what living things do. We all investigate our surroundings. My job, though, is to go out and record and come back, stay alive long enough and come back.
And your approach that you developed was going solo, just by yourself, with a camera and doing everything yourself.
Yeah, the camera came quite late. I wrote about 5 books, I think, before I did any telly. And then this invention came along, the camcorder. I mean, this is quite a long time ago now, but the video camcorder, everyone's very excited about this thing. And the BBC said, please, can you take this on an expedition? So I was never really a presenter. I was simply an explorer, or you could say an adventurer, or perhaps an environmental scientist, which is what my degree was in. And off I would go on my adventures and record whatever happened. And I didn't know if I was going to come back or not. Obviously, I hoped I was going to. The BBC certainly did, because I had all this footage. And I used to just come back, no health and safety, nothing, no film crew. It was just a proper expedition. And the technology developed, and now everyone does video selfies. But in that stage, it was just me.
And do you think TV viewers today might have different expectations from programmes, given what people have become used to with reality TV and so on?
Things have changed hugely, to the extent that I really was overtaken by everyone else. It wasn't interesting enough to see some bloke walking along through a desert. I walked up the Skeleton Coast, for example, and that journey had never been recorded before. And it was a wonderful thing to be able to do with my 3 camels. And at the time, people were amazed, thinking, wow, he's really alone out there. No set-up shots. He doesn't know if he's going to get through this. We don't know if he's going to get through this. And it was enough. But now I look back, as I suppose people were at the time, thinking, it's starting to get a bit claustrophobic. You know, you don't get the beautiful shots. You don't get the beautiful sound. No drone buzzing overhead that gives you the perspective. It's just some bloke with his struggle. I suppose this was in the 1990s. Time moved on and people wanted the beautiful shots. But what, of course, they miss is the real... the jeopardy, the do or die bit. It's you could say it's faked now, or it's certainly staged very much on telly.
You talk about the jeopardy. You were in jeopardy, I'm sure, on many occasions. But still, is there an element of tourism in the kind of trips that you were undertaking? Because you are going for an experience abroad. You are interacting with the locals, hoping to get something out of it for yourself. And you're coming back and sharing your stories. Is that a kind of tourism? Maybe like ultra tourism, because almost nobody can do this kind of thing.
Tourism, it's funny, I didn't think anyone was quite asked that, because people think of it as immersion. I mean, I'd be going to places that hadn't, not necessarily actually hadn't been recorded, but certainly they hadn't been interpreted, or there were places that were misunderstood, you could say. So it needn't be exploration in that classic sense. I mean, I have made first contact with 2 very remote lots of people who were being overrun by missionaries and so on. But I'd say tourism is probably the wrong word, because it sounds like someone who's just sort of tripping in and out. And each expedition actually would take 6 months, 9 months, a huge amount of time. And in that process, it's all about trying to immerse yourself. So that might mean learning a language. It might mean certainly bedding yourself in to a society and their culture with a sort of considerable commitment. So maybe it's just a personal pride, but I like to think of that it's a slight difference between a sort of tour package and what I do. But nonetheless, I do think there's a huge amount of arrogance about the profession I'm in, because by making yourself into a hero or allowing yourself to be portrayed as a sort of new Indiana Jones, which I've been called, you're sort of using the world as a platform and making yourself better than really you are. After all, in a lot of the places I've lived in, say in the Amazon, these environments have been seen not only as a home, which is the word I used earlier, but as a resource of food, medicine, shelter. They're not places you need to struggle through, and yet time and again on the telly we see our heroes battling against the elements when the locals, I know very well, might be just gathering fruit on a day out, you know, as they walk through the forest. So I've got to be quite careful about that in my career, and I think certainly my earlier days I was seen as too heroic, and I've got a new book called Explorer, and that doesn't, it doesn't have me on the cover, and I think it's probably important that it doesn't, because actually the place is what it's meant to be about, not the person.
Reading your biography, you have been in many, many extreme situations that most of us wouldn't last an hour in. But still, what do you regard as the most dangerous situation that you've been in your career?
There have been a few contenders. I was memorably, for me at least, I was crossing the Amazon Basin at its widest, which is something that hadn't been done. And I just was interested to sort of do a cross-section of the Amazon. And it took me a long, long time, 8 months. But there was a time I had to pass through Colombia, and I was going down the Putumayo River in a canoe. And unfortunately, I went past the place where Pablo Escobar was hiding out, or at least his intimate team. He was on the run. He was actually killed 6 months later in Medellin. And you know who I mean, the drug baron. And either he or his close associates sent two people to kill me. I mean, I was just in the wrong place at the wrong time, going right past his camp. He was hiding out on the border between Peru, Brazil and Colombia. And, these two people chased me up the river. And I was just very lucky they were incompetent. they couldn't fire a rifle and paddle at the same time because they were town people. And I wasn't that good at paddling, but luckily I could paddle enough to get around the river bend. And so, you know, scary moment, six bullets, I think, they all went past my head. And I got away with it.
Well, now we're a very long way from the jungle. What led you to Prague, Benedict?
5 years ago, I had this brilliant idea. I said to my wife, who's Czech, why didn't we just live in Czech Republic for a year? Wouldn't it be wonderful?
And you guys had met in the UK?
We're living in the UK. I think we'd been there 15 years. Everything was going well. We had three children. I said, well, let's live in the Czech Republic for a year. And we came over, and we're still here. We haven't negotiated successfully, at least, about whether we're going back again, because my wife says we should be here, and I'm sure she's right.
How did your kids find the transition, just out of curiosity?
They found the one who's now 14. She's, I think for a time, she became very much more Czech than British. I think she wanted to feel connected to the space that she'd suddenly been plonked in Prague. My son, he feels he's very British. He keeps on talking about dear old England, far more than me. And the littlest one, who's only six, she's essentially Czech.
You're known for acquiring skills from indigenous people on your travels. Have you also applied this approach to living in the Czech Republic? Have you tried to go native?
My wife would say distinctly, no, I haven't tried, not tried hard enough. I think she's, my wife's working on it, and I suppose I am gradually adapting. But the truth is that my expeditions have never been close to home, and when I was living in the UK in a place called Twickenham, I'd be launching out into the world, and I sort of mentally, because I travel alone and because sometimes it can be dangerous, I tend to need to think of home as the safe place to come back to. And same now for Prague. But that to me is a good sign. It's a good sign that we are gradually settling into the Czech Republic, because this has become home. And it's the safe place that I need my children to be in, my wife to be in, when I go off and do my danger stuff.
One thing I'm curious about is when you go on these solo trips for many months, obviously you interact with the locals to some degree, but you're on your own. How do you adjust back to normal life being around other people after that?
It's always the hardest part of any expedition for me, because after all, I'm meant to be a professional. The business of integrating with other cultures should be what I do. It's my skill set, and for me now, rainforest, desert, the Arctic, I can cope unless I do something really silly. And yet, something as personal, something as unfathomable, really, as the bond you have with your family, it's very, very hard. And it's got much harder since I've had children, of course, but I find it very difficult. When I head off on an expedition, I'm very focused, maybe a bit lonely as I pack and everything, but I have a job ahead of me. Coming back, it's very, very difficult. It's much quicker coming back than going out, because going out, I'd have to adjust climatically and so on, and culturally to people. But going back, you just jump on the plane, and it's very difficult. I tend not to talk about work with people. When I say work, it'd be my adventure, which a lot of people might be intrigued about. But I tend to keep at a distance so that I'm established again as being home and in a different place. But
Is it even weird sleeping in a bed, having heating and all this kind of stuff after you've been... whatever.
It is. I think I'm getting softer. I tend to do allow myself to sleep on something at least when I'm in the rainforest. But yeah, it is. Even something like having to sleep in a room without a window open becomes very hard. I feel claustrophobic. The sounds are different. I remember stepping out of the Amazon when I was much younger and just walking along a road and feeling that surface, that flat surface, I found bewildering. And that shows what a sort of state of mind I must have been in. I was so used to walking on roots and mud, and suddenly a surface. At the same time, it is reassuring. But I think the hardest thing is that when you've been in the middle of nowhere, you're longing for home. It's the place sometimes when I've had malaria 5 times, and when you're semi-delirious, you need to believe that you can get back. You need to be able to focus on your loved ones in order to sort of lift yourself out of your condition. And then you come back to the reality. And of course, it can't match up, because it's lovely to be with your children and wife, of course. But it's not perfection, because life isn't like that. And that is a hard thing to cope with. There's no stimulation, really. You know, it's not like being shot at when you come home. So you haven't got that adrenaline to help you through. And actually, things are quite dull after a while. And that's hard. You've got to fight that and do your duty to your friends and family and try and be normal, which is not easy.
And that interview with British adventurer Benedikt Allen brings us to the end of today's programme from Prague. You'll find us at radio.cz. If you'd like to get in touch, don't hesitate to contact us. The address is english@radio.cz. We'll be glad to hear from you. And remember, you can follow Radio Prague on Facebook and Twitter as well. This is Daniela Lazarová saying thanks for listening and take care.